We respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia where this podcast was recorded, as the first storytellers, the first communities, and the first creators of Australian culture. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hi there, I'm Daniel Moore, and you're listening to Season 4 of the Hearing Architecture Podcast, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dave Bickmore and Graham Carbonell, registered architects and directors of Studio Graham, based in South Australia. Dave and Graham are two of Australia's most successful emerging architects, with one of the most impressive practice portfolios, catching the eye of design experts in Australia and abroad. In 2018, Studio Graham was awarded the prestigious Emerging Interior Practice of the Year, and they were also the 2022 South Australian recipient of the Australian Institute of Architects Emerging Architect Prize. In this episode, we talk about the way they bootstrapped their firm when they first started, how they don't follow one style or influence in their work, and how they hope the architecture profession can help in areas such as mental health and not just talk about the issues. Let's jump in.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Dave. It's really great that we're going to be talking about Studio Graham. And I think Graham is on his way, so he'll be joining us mid-conversation, which is great. You know, it's like really like we're in the studio with you. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's really great to chat.
No, thank you for having us. It's really excited to be on the pod.
Yeah, thanks so much, mate. So I think, you know, architects around the country know that Studio Graham is delivering incredible work at the moment, not just on a national scale, but also internationally with the recognition you've received as, you know, winning your international award for best interiors work. And you're also kicking goals on smaller projects, but then also on really massive projects. But I'd really love to know, for our audience to hear a little bit about the genesis of the practice. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how you started Studio Graham and a couple of these really interesting projects that got you guys off the ground?
It probably depends how far back you want to go, but I think the roots of Studio Graham were probably, you know, late or so on at our time at university, I think. Graham and I, we kind of formed this relationship, you know, at university where we're really honest with each other and we're also open to, you know, constructive feedback and criticism at that point in time. And we'd always intended, I think, in working together in some form, but we probably didn't know that it would be so early in our careers, I think, post-graduation. But we formed a really strong relationship there and we went off to work at large commercial practices for a few years. And Graham left his role a little earlier than I did and started as a sole practitioner working on a few different projects for a client based in Sydney, and then landed a hotel project called Hotel Harry, which was really the project that allowed me to leave my role at Hassell and come and join Graham. And really that was when things kicked off. So we both, you know, I was 26 at the time and Graham was, I think, 31. So mm-hmm. relatively young and probably naive, I think, about running a practice. And we really had very little hospitality experience, but we were both excited by the opportunity to work interstate on a project in Sydney. And the fee that we had secured allowed both of us to support our lifestyles and, you know, commitments for 12 months. And really, I guess that's how we entered into it, was, you know, we'll see what happens over the next 12 months. And if it doesn't work out, we'll presume the normal architectural journey. But we were both graduates at the time starting our own practice, and I guess, you know, that was fortuitous. I think around that same time there was also a change in legislation here in South Australia. Yeah. Really, Studio Graham, I think, is the product of, or is one outcome of positive kind of reform or legislation, and in that the state government announced the small venue license, which was, well, it was a piece of legislation that allowed people to apply for liquor licenses with very little red tape, and really unlocked a lot of investment in small bars and restaurants off the back of, I think there was a similar reform in Newcastle, I believe. So borrowing some of the the learnings from what had happened in the eastern states. They implemented the small venue license, and our practice really benefited from that, in that we were one of the only practices in Adelaide that had real hospitality experience, even though we had only been working on one or two at the time. But yeah, we had some work to kind of demonstrate our experience in that area. And that really kicked off Studio Grand.
Oh, it's so fantastic. And I think, you know, coming from a big practice where they have all of these incredible systems and resources in place is one way of practicing, which is fantastic. Feel fully supported, and, you know, it's a great environment to cut your teeth. Then going into a small practice and doing everything, you know, flying by the seat of your pants is another kind of experience. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, yeah, Hotel Harry, where you kind of had really short time frames and, you know, you really had to deliver this first project of yours to get your, you know, get you on the map, and how you managed all of those complexities on that project?
Yeah, having cut our teeth at big practices, we applied, I guess, that professional practice to our small studio. And I think that that definitely helped us on Hotel Harry. It wasn't the smoothest construction process in that the builder went bust. So we quickly had to, you know, implement, you know, what we'd learned, you know, through professional practice in terms of how to managing that process of ensuring that the client was protected for everything they'd paid for on site and all of the stuff that comes with closing out a project without a builder. But yeah, look, it was, whilst the back end of Studio Graham, I think, was quite sound in that we, you know, we were using what we'd learned at big practice. We were really bootstrapping, you know, we were working out of a co-working space, sometimes out of a car, but we were just doing anything we could just to get things done. And in hospitality, the projects move at such a pace that there really wasn't any off switch. We were working all the time. And, you know, at that point in time, I think we were turning over a project from start to finish within about 4 to 5 months. So we quickly built a portfolio, which in hindsight, I think is one of the real benefits. One of the things that benefits Geogram was we had this portfolio of work within 1 or 2 years that was quite extensive, where if I think we entered into the residential market or sector straight away, it would have taken 1 or 2 years to be able to photograph a project and have built work on our website. So yeah, while it wasn't by design, I think it definitely helped us build a portfolio in that space.
Yeah, definitely. And I love hearing about how you were delivering the project from your car. I think, were you at a festival or something when you were trying to send drawings through?
Like, obviously, as you do when you first start, you know, a practice, you take on projects that are really exciting and may not necessarily be conventional architectural projects. And one of the projects we were engaged for was the Red Bull Music Academy stage at Splendor in the Grass. And so we were doing bump in at the festival, like designing things as they were kind of being built. But at the same time, we had to deliver a joinery package for Hotel Harry. And I recall we were driving around Byron Bay at around 4:30 or 5 a.m. in the morning looking for free Wi-Fi, sitting out the front of houses trying to upload documents. So, you know, I guess they're the things that you have to do when resources are limited. But, you know, we look back, we laugh at it now, we got it done. You know, yeah, it was it was kind of exciting, and in some ways we still miss some of that now that we've grown to a team of nine. But it's quite fun.
Yeah, no, it's just such a fantastic example, I think, of you know, just doing what you need to do to get stuff done. And it sounds like Graham's just walked into the studio.
He's just walking in the door, yeah.
Yeah. Great.
I was just talking about driving around Byron Bay looking for free Wi-Fi. Good timing.
Thanks so much for joining us, Graham. So yeah, we're just touching on the first couple of hospitality projects that Studio Graham worked on, and yeah, how that sort of, I guess, got you to establish Studio Graham quite quickly with the hospitality projects you got across the line. And Dave did mention the legislation that sort of cut back the red tape for small businesses to get a liquor license and open in South Australia. And I think Studio Graham's, you know, it's quite an exceptional practice in that not only do you design for hospitality businesses, but you're also part owners in some of those. Do you want to talk about your experience now in being designers of hospitality, but now also operating some of these hospitality businesses and how they feed together?
Yeah, sure. I wouldn't I wouldn't lay claim to actually operating them. So we are partners in one venue now. We've actually recently sold one of them, but we let other people operate them. But we're quite heavily involved in the just in the design stuff up front, and then in an ongoing capacity as well. It gives us a really great opportunity to kind of continually influence the spaces. I think one of the upsetting things sometimes with hospitality is you can kind of take it to that opening day, and then as the space evolves, depending on the client, you aren't overly involved. So, you know, definitely one of the beauties of kind of being involved beyond just the upfront design work is the capacity to be able to kind of allow the space and the place to kind of evolve along with the business as it grows.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that you definitely can't get with residential as well. As soon as the project's delivered, you might get invited to a barbecue every once in a while, but then the clients won't come along always and say, you know, oh, let's you know, change the roof or add something to this, you know, every 6 months. So I think that's got to have its own advantages as well. And I guess this is, I mean, we've already touched on how Adelaide had this incredible legislation. Like what do you think has been also the benefit of staying in Adelaide, which I guess compared to maybe New South Wales or Victoria might feel like is a smaller market? I mean, do you think that that's also benefited the way that you've designed and the connections you've made with your clients?
Yeah, I mean, there's a smallness to Adelaide, which is great. I think it allows us to do a lot of things in terms of kind of connection to people. There's some really brilliant makers here that we have great relationships with. And, you know, Adelaide's the 20-minute city, so nothing's ever kind of out of reach in terms of actually getting out to people's workshops or, you know, if it's growers out in the hills when we're doing different hospitality projects and trying to understand what our clients might be bringing into those venues as well. But there's that kind of has a big part to play in what we do and how we do it in Adelaide. And I think the other beauty is that Adelaide, for us, I guess outside of architecture, we just really love living here for those same reasons. You know, it's a great city, but it also offers us the opportunity to kind of get out of it as well. We both have young families, so it's good for that. I think the other probably key benefits is, you know, when we started StudioGram, there weren't a lot of small practices, I don't think, in Adelaide. So, you know, we weren't one amongst many as we would be in Sydney and Melbourne. So we saw some opportunity in that. I was actually in Melbourne when we were doing our first few projects as StudioGram. But funnily enough, we had projects in Sydney, projects in Indonesia. Dave was in Adelaide, I was in Melbourne, and my partner at the time, who's now my wife, was still in Adelaide. So living in Melbourne didn't make a lot of sense. It became quite a kind of an expensive storage container, essentially, that I went back and repacked my bags from every once in a while.
And just to add to that, I think the smallness of Adelaide played a big role in growing our profile here as well. I think with the style of work that we were doing in the early days, which was mainly hospitality, they're very forward-facing projects. And because of this new investment and interest in hospitality venues in the city, people were seeing this change in design quality, and, you know, people would ask who's doing it. And off the back of those types of projects, we would get leads in residential projects or other commercial projects. And I think that played a big role in building a profile really quickly.
Yeah. Well, I guess people would be talking with each other and chatting with their neighbors over the fence to say, you know, have you been to that new restaurant? You know, I know who the designers are. We went to school with them, that sort of thing, which can be a real advantage in a small town as well. I know that I've got that experience when I go to Hobart. So, yeah, I can understand that would also be a benefit, you know, that people would also be quite upfront and honest with you as well, like with your staff, talking about work-life balance and what the experience of being an architect in Adelaide can be. You know, you don't have to follow the mold of other cities. Have you seen that play out very much for StudioGram as a practice? Because I think you're now entering your 10th year this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've just turned 10. We probably haven't thought a lot about our role in the broader profession, I think, until the last sort of couple of years, I think. And and I guess I think we probably were a little bit, not negligent. I think we just weren't really focused on, I think for us, it's probably the last couple of years we've really paid more attention to what role we have in the broader profession, but also in the local kind of architectural community. And obviously there's been some changes in our practice in that we've taken well, we bought a building and we're currently fitting out our new studio. And that really came at a point in time where I think we were starting to question what impact we had and how we could positively contribute to the community. And so we've really tried to start to think about that and think about what our new studio represents and how it represents us. And I guess part of that comes from maybe being a little bit frustrated with some of the other practices that do a lot of talking, in particular about things like mental health and work-life balance, and in our opinion, probably don't practice what they're preaching. And we see this opportunity with the new studio to challenge some of them and hopefully change the way that as an industry we go about it.
I think it's almost an approach of like less talking and more doing. It's kind of, you know, we've gotten to this point, I think, where, and I don't know what it's like nationally, but it feels like in South Australia once every 6 months or once a quarter, there's another talk on mental health and the state of the industry and working hours and all of that kind of stuff. But it seems to be that that's what is being done about it. There's another talk to talk about how bad it is. And we've been, I think, you know, we've always tried to be proactive in the background. One of the reasons we left Big Practice and started StudioGram, because we, I guess, always held the belief that you could produce good architecture and still have a life outside of architecture. That was really important to us. And, you know, we work really hard and so do the staff in our office to leave on time, you know, probably 95% of the time. We typically operate from 8:30 till 5 o'clock, and you would struggle to kind of find the lights on or people in the studio past 5:30 pretty much 5 days a week. And, you know, someone's in there on the weekend, it's probably because they're working on their mom's kitchen or, you know, the in-laws ensuite that they're doing outside of hours or something similar, but it's typically not project work. And we're really proud of that. And it's not something that's been public, and it's not why we do it either. But I think with the new studio, we're kind of designing in opportunities to kind of expand some kind of wellness offering, and we don't really know what that looks like yet or exactly how it's going to play out, but it's kind of there, and it'll evolve as we kind of settle into the space and understand what we can and can't offer. But there'll certainly be things that we open to the broader industry, and it won't be about having a conversation about issues with the industry. It'll be about, you know, whether we bring like a mindfulness coach in or someone to do breath work, run a yoga class after hours or on a Tuesday afternoon or something. But part of it will also us giving back to the industry, but also I think a way to test the industry a little bit as well. And some of those things probably will occur during office hours. And, you know, hopefully a lot of these other practices that kind of preach about well-being will, you know, allow their staff bodies to kind of attend things that are about their well-being during office hours as well, and not rely on them only undertaking those kinds of activities on their own time.
Yeah, because I think those offerings sound fantastic, and I agree that it would be so good if all practices had that as, you know, one of their pillars in their mission statement to make sure that we're taking care of people's mental health. And, you know, I think even those simple things that you've mentioned, those things about trying to be quite strict about, you know, what your office hours are, and then making sure that we're checking in with people just to say, you know, okay, so you passed here past, you know, after five. Is this necessary? Do we need to reevaluate what our fees are or how we structure the workload? Do you think that that's also a potential missing piece, is just that openness with the conversation around like how much staff can take on and being really upfront with the whole team when you're putting bids in? Is that another thing that you think could factor into it?
Yeah, we think it stems right down into like just simple timesheets. You know, when we were at Big Practice, and obviously it's, you know, at least 10 years ago, but other people within the industry will say the same. I think that there's a bit of a false economy with timesheets with a lot of practices, that, you know, you're only able to put down your 7.5 or 8 hours on a project, or even if you can put down more hours, you almost feel compelled to put down the standard working hours because it looks like you're inefficient, where we've taken an approach that we ask all the staff to put down the exact hours, and we've been able to do this from the outset so that we proper data, proper metrics that we can base our fees on, and meaning that when we're pricing your projects, it's priced on the, you know, the true number of hours required to deliver a project. And I think we've obviously, because we're a small practice and We've been able to do it from the outset. I guess we've been able to challenge those simple conventions.
And it's all, I've been seeing, you know, more and more practices on large scale projects doing more collaboration. And I think, you know, there's an interesting piece there as well, where practices that seem to always in the past wanted to grow and get to a large practice scale, but now are saying both large practices and medium and even quite small being brought into projects where they're collaborating all together to produce some great work. How are you managing that? And have you found that that's also fed into, I guess, you know, splitting the load so that then, you know, if you're taking on a massive project, it's not all on your staff's shoulders or all on your shoulders as well to deliver these massive projects?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of, well, not that recently anymore, but we did Monardo. That was completed, how long ago now? Two years ago, yeah. I think. Yeah. So
congratulations on all your awards at the South Australian Architecture Awards. So that was great.
Yeah, I mean, time disappears quickly on that. But we did that with Intro, and it was probably the first big project we delivered in collaboration with another practice. And it was a true collaboration in the sense that there wasn't really a scope split. So it was really about kind of combining the practices in terms of our resources and working through it rather than kind of dividing and conquering. And that was a great kind of opportunity for us to get involved in some bigger work and also to kind of bring, I guess, our design sensibilities to that type of work. But it did allow us to kind of keep moving forward with, I guess, the projects that we still want to do. And we're doing quite a few larger projects at the moment in different capacities. And I think the beauty for us in collaborating with other practices on those types of projects is it does allow us to still operate at the smaller scale. And it's certainly something that we don't want to lose. We're kind of dipping our toes in terms of bigger commercial work to see if it's somewhere that we want to take Studiogram or not. So there's a few, I guess, test projects at the moment that we're working through, but all of them have been structured in a way that we aren't kind of going at these projects that require large resource allocations and kind of putting our whole studio on them. And that's, I think, one of the things that collaborating with bigger practices offers on these types of projects. So we can commit a smaller amount of resources to the project, still have a lot of kind of valuable input as we see it. But we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket. So invariably, when that project goes on hold, as most projects, bigger projects tend to do at different phases, they're also not kind of killing the back end of our studio in terms of actually having work for people to do. So, and they're not chewing our resources to the point or forcing us into this kind of exponential growth pattern just to feed these, that it then means we can no longer be competitive on smaller work.
Well, I always think it's fascinating looking at the portfolio of Studiogram, because you see you've got the Monardo Safari Park, and then you've also got Ponyfish Island in Melbourne, which is, I mean, it's almost like the total antithesis of each other. Where what is Ponyfish, what, 20 square meters or 30 square meters in total? I can't, like, it's so
it's
tiny.
It's a bit bigger than that, but there's a lot of kind of hidden space. Well, not a lot, certainly the clients wouldn't say it's a lot, but there's a fair amount of hidden space at Ponyfish. So it's almost probably 50% of it is kind of back of house, including amenities, bar, and then some kind of puzzle-like storage compartments in and around bridge structure. But yeah, it's pretty small and pretty limited, I guess, in what you could do with it. But the smaller ones than that, I mean, you know, Pirate Life is a kind of long-time client of ours, and we're actually just delivered and about to open a place in South Melbourne with Pirate Life. But funnily enough, we've also just handed over the ensuite of one of Pirate Life's founders. And that's not a, you know, that's not an advertisement for projects we want to do, I guess. But considering the friendship there over the years we've worked with him, we agreed to do his ensuite for him. So yeah, at the moment we kind of had a bit of a laugh the other day talking about our projects, and we were like, they range from an ensuite up to kind of the $190 million mark is the upper end of the scale at the moment. So it's a bit of a gap and lots of stuff in between, to be honest, as well. So there's a lot of kind of, yeah, quite a few scales being ticked at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I think when you were mentioning before, you know, the sort of the projects that that can bring down the staff morale or enthusiasm might be some of those big projects that might drag on for a very long time, just because there's so much design work, documentation, coordination, all of those things factoring into them. And then those short, sharp super exciting projects with, you know, just delighted clients who are happy that they're able to work with Studio Gram that can pump you up again. Do you ever have sort of a heat map of, you know, okay, that project's going to go for a long time, might have a bit of a slow burn, and this one's like, you know, very hot. Everyone would love to work on this client who loves color or loves texture. Anything that you evaluate in the practice that way?
We probably don't have so much that issue where, you know, you'll have one or two staff members working on a project that no one wants to work on, or working on a project for, you know, 3 or 4 years in isolation. I think because of the smallness of our practice, we tend to all work on every project. You know, there'll be obviously the team expands and contracts throughout the lifespan of a project, but we tend to all touch various aspects of each project. And I think that is one of the dynamic or exciting parts of working at Studio Gram, is that, yeah, you might be working on a, you know, access toilet, or you might be designing joinery, and then the next day you could be working on an apartment multi-res, you know, tower. So it is one of the things that it gets us out of bed and excites us. It's probably confusing sometimes for our clientele, you know, what is Studio Gram and what do we do? But we try to be selective about the projects we take on, and, you know, whilst it may not look like it externally, internally, we do try and make sure it fits, or make sure a project fits within the lifestyle sector, or the hotels, houses and hospitality, as we like to call it. So they're kind of the streams that we're trying to stick within. And, you know, if there's an area of opportunity in South Australia, or even, you know, more broadly, we'll have a look at it, providing that we can actually add some value. And I think that's where, you know, we see the housing market in South Australia being a real opportunity to kind of lift design quality. And, you know, as we get older, I think, you know, if you look at our aesthetic, which is quite varied, I think, you know, probably as we get older, it shifts as well. And I think that's the other benefit of Studio Gram. You know, it's not just Graham and I, and we've got a heap of people that work with us at various points in their lives, and they put their own, you know, touch and DNA in each of the projects. So it is quite dynamic in that sense as well. And something we're proud of too, you know, that you can, you know, if you look at Odgy and Abbotson Kinney, which are two hospitality venues in Adelaide that are side by side, you wouldn't know, I don't think, that one practice designed both venues. And I think that's, you know, for us, that's something that we're really proud of, that when we approach a new project, it's from first principles, and we don't have a particular aesthetic or our own beliefs that we try and apply to the project. I think if we did, we'd probably would have run out of work in a place like Adelaide. And that's where maybe the smallness of Adelaide would have been counterproductive, because I think people in the hospitality sector wouldn't have wanted the same thing as down the road. So yeah, that's probably hasn't been a commercial decision to not repeat details. And
there's not a lot of standard details getting pulled from one project to the next, but keeps everyone excited about what they're working on. But I guess, yeah, in fact, to the question, we don't have, I guess what you see is what you get with us in terms of, you know, our website and our Instagram. There aren't the projects that nobody wants to work on that kind of sit in the corner that make us money. We kind of celebrate every project we work on, and we're really fortunate, I think, that we've gotten to a position where we can be selective about the work that we take on. And I guess, as Dave mentioned, unless we can see a way that we can add value to it, but also the way that the project can probably add value to what we're doing and what we're learning and kind of enriching our kind of practice, then we don't really see, I guess, the opportunity in those projects. And then we'll kind of pass on them or recommend someone else who might be more appropriate for that work.
I think it's very interesting when you're mentioning things like how dynamic your practice is, and also the references you mentioned where there are two restaurants side by side and people might not know that they were both designed by Studio Gram. When it comes to your office after 10 years, where now you can do whatever you want, what direction are you planning to go down with that particular project? Because I guess you want to put, you know, show that you're walking the walk as well as talking the talk, and surrounding yourself with your design ethos. What direction do you think you're going to go with your space?
Well, it's kind of, I got some timber samples in the back of my car actually that I just picked up for part of it. But it's well and truly under construction. So the linings are kind of going in this week, and we're looking at probably a roughly kind of 6 week move-in date, essentially. So kind of mid-April, we should be in there. But it's probably more in line with the way that we approach all of our projects. So it's kind of a it's a reflection of us, but it's also a reflection of the space and what it is. It's a, you know, it was a mechanics workshop. It was built to be a mechanics workshop. So the mechanic that we bought it off of built it in 1978, I think. So we wanted to kind of stay as true to that as we could, but keeping in mind that, you know, it is going to become a design studio and a creative space, and we're going to kind of live in there and work in there and breathe in there. So we needed to do something about the grease, but we're keeping it kind of as raw as we can while still adding kind of our design sensibilities to it. So there is, you know, the materiality generally is quite raw. There's some really nice, I hope, joinery pieces. You know, joinery is pretty close to our hearts, whether it's a kind of big project or a small project. We're kind of pretty meticulous about details, particularly within the joinery. There's some pretty rudimentary, I guess, if that's the right word, kind of construction techniques within it. And a lot of that is probably an intentional way of putting some of what's happening on display. So it's not about kind of lining everything. And that's probably a bit of an education piece for people that come into the space, but it's also a bit of a representation of the building. You know, it's effectively like it's a steel portal that had infill block work between the columns. And that's about as complicated as the kind of original fabric gets. So we've kind of incorporated that into the way that we've treated new structures as well. And, you know, and we'll kind of get rid of as much of the concrete in the front yard as we can and put in as much garden as we can to help soften the space and create a little bit more of a street presence. You know, as you'd expect, it was kind of designed and built to fit as many cars as they possibly could between the footpath and the front door. So we're trying to change that. But yeah, you know, I think it's ultimately, it will be, I think, just a reflection of all of our projects. So it does talk to us and I guess the kind of space that we want to be in and live in and work in, but then also the kind of space that talks to the building that it's part of. You know, so it's not a new build. So we had to kind of react and respond to the fabric that was there. The other thing, I guess that we touched on it briefly earlier, but this idea of kind of the wellness and probably a bit broader, like an event space. So we have designed it in a way that will enable us to kind of push and pull desks out of the way. And there'll be kind of around 90 to 100 square meters of kind of open floor space, which will allow for events. So whether it's a wellness event or, you know, we've kind of partnered with a few suppliers on this project to make it a reality. And we're going to give up our space to them for certain events that they want to host within that space. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of flexibility and adaptability designed into it as well, so that it doesn't just live as a design studio. Mm-hmm. And part of that, trying to connect with the broader industry, but also the public. I think, you know, architects are, I think, last time you and I spoke, we spoke about this a little bit at dinner, but, you know, architects, I think, are really good at talking to other architects about architecture. You know, even the magazines that everyone wants to be published in or the books that we all buy, they're very kind of self-serving. And that, you know, that's great in a lot of ways. But I think one thing that we aren't great at doing is actually welcoming people and showing them what we do outside of the finished product. So, you know, we don't know how it all kind of eventuates, but a lot of that thinking has been based around this opportunity for our space to not just be about producing work, but also about having people in there in different capacities.
You know, it sounds like an incredible distillation of what eventuates in a lot of studiograms work. I think, you know, if you're talking about expressing an honesty of materials, bringing people together, not being hemmed in by one particular style. So it feels like it's going to function for all of those things. What's the biggest piece that you would actually like the public to be welcomed into in terms of an architectural conversation? Because I think your space is going to function really well with that sort of size to have events. What do you think we should be saying more to the public and really enrolling them in some of these conversations that maybe we only have with architects at the moment?
I think in the Adelaide context, it's trying to demonstrate and educate what the role of an architect, what value the role of an architect can have on a project. I think that's particularly poignant in Adelaide and South Australia, where even people with big budgets will go to a builder before they go to an architect. And if I think about how we approach a project and our own beliefs in our own skills, in that we will do what we're good at, but we won't step outside that. And I think there's a lot of value in that thinking in terms of, you know, while, you know, people should use an architect to design their home and a builder to construct it, I think that's one element that I think that the new studio hopefully be able to offer, particularly as we're moving into Brompton, which is going through this, I won't call it gentrification, but this kind of redevelopment of former industrial land, the gasworks, which is, from what I'm told, was the second most contaminated site in Australia to the gasworks site. But we're on that project with a Melbourne developer, and you know, that'll see a huge infill site be properly decontaminated and redeveloped. And, you know, hopefully that allows us to, because our office is only 200 metres down the road from that site, it will actually allow us to almost act as a site office and have people that potentially are buying a townhouse or an apartment into our studio to see how we operate, so that they can see, you know, the kind of farm to table experience, you know, the designing and the ideation and then right through to delivery, I think would be really exciting. And hopefully that fills in a piece of that education piece as to what we actually do. Because I think a lot of people still don't understand what architects do and what the title of an architect means.
Yeah, I think there's a huge role for us to play in kind of explaining, I think, the personal aspect that architects bring to a project. And that's, I think generally speaking, architects do that, but I think speaking particularly to the way that we work and the way that we inject, I guess, our clients' sensibilities into our, it's really about that, you know, it's something that's designed specifically for someone or for a group of people. So whether it's, you know, a restaurant or a home, but it's always targeted at someone specific. And I think I heard, I think it was Nielsen Jenkins recently speaking about how the real estate industry has kind of done a disservice to architecture, because, you know, that initial client meeting, particularly in the residential space, is often centered around resale value. It's, you know, it's my forever home, but I don't want to diminish the resale value. And, you know, there's this constant thought. And I think in some ways, like, the really simple way to kind of compare architecture, particularly in the residential space, to what you get out of a builder is, you know, you're out of a builder, you're probably getting a generic resale home. And out of an architect, you're getting something bespoke and specific to you, your personality, your wants, your needs, the way that you live, the way you entertain, you know. So it's really a process about kind of understanding someone and then being able to provide something to kind of enhance the way that they live their lives. And I don't think that's just about residential architecture either, but it's really about understanding the end user of the space so that you can design to their requirements. And I think that's a really key kind of missing piece. And I don't know that the general public really thinks that's what architects do. I don't think they put a lot of separation between us and kind of anyone else that draws a building, really. They just see it as like someone who's providing a service to create a series of drawings, kind of enable the approvals that are required to build something. So, you know, there's that piece. And, you know, hopefully through opening up our studio and kind of putting what we do on show to a certain aspect, we'll be able to kind of show people that process in some way.
I think your work and your, by the sounds of your studio, will be a way to inspire people to be more bold, to be themselves and to, you know, actually live to their fullest extent. And they might not realize that they can do that with their home if they're, you know, because they're so focused on the resale of what someone else will want as opposed to what they would want for themselves. So yeah, I think that even looking through especially looking through the studio grant portfolio, I find that work just so inspiring because it does elevate what architecture and design can be, especially for the younger people out there, you know, the students or the graduates who are working around Australia and internationally at the moment. What do you hope to inspire other architects to do anything in particular in their work that that you don't see as much of at the moment, which you'd love to see more of?
That was a deep question. I don't know. I should think about that. I mean, I think it's probably not, less, for me anyways, it's probably less about inspiring them to do a certain type of work, but it's probably more about inspiring them to stay true to themselves. You know, I think everyone has their own reasons for studying architecture, and there are probably unique reasons for doing that. So I think it's about when you kind of move from your education piece into professional practice of some description, it's really, I think, important to stay true to the reason you were attracted to architecture in the first instance. And I think a lot of that can get lost. You know, the reason Dave and I took the leap, I guess, when we decided to leave big practice was that, you know, we both, I think, for different reasons, studied architecture because we really wanted to design houses, essentially. You know, we were interested in residential work, and we went through a 5-year university program, including a master's, and we never had a design studio where we got to design a house. And you know, then we went into big practice and we're working on, you know, retail centers and residential towers and schools and everything else. And we still had never had the opportunity to work on a house. And it was one of the big reasons we just said, well, let's just start our own practice. And then funnily enough, we fell into this kind of wealth of hospitality work, and we've really loved that. And there's kind of pretty deep connections there to the way we are as people, I guess. And that's why we've really enjoyed doing that work. But it's also led to now quite a lot of residential work. So I guess in being true to what we had interest in terms of what led us to studying architecture, we probably found ourselves in the position that we're in now, where we genuinely get to work on projects that we enjoy every day.
Yeah, Dave, were you going to say something as well?
I'm not sure. I think this probably gets back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, only the last couple of years really thinking about the role that we have in the profession. I think what I hope, well, if I think about the legacy that Studio Graham might have when Graham and I choose to retire one day, I hope that the practice, you know, kind of facilitates this freedom for people to work within it and do what they are currently interested in. And I think that's probably one thing that we've learned, that, you know, you don't have to prescribe to a particular style or material and, you know, explore that for years on end, which many of the contemporaries that we looked up to did. For us, it's been an exploration through projects on an individual basis. And, you know, the intent behind the name of Studio Graham was that it lived on longer than Graham and I. And, you know, one day when we're not there, there'll be people that will put their own kind of stamp on it. And I think that hopefully kind of inspires people, if they, you know, to want to work at Studio Graham, you know, that they can actually, you know, impact or positively influence projects. But yeah, I won't get any deeper than that.
Yeah, that's totally fair enough. I feel like, yeah, because there's so many great examples in your work of just beautiful design, I find it very, and as I've already said, it's inspiring to me. When I met with some clients and builders, when you do talk about, you might be talking about value management, and people will say, "Oh, just do this. You know, it's simple. Just use the standard material, the standard detailing." And I wish the conversation could move around to like, "Let's just do something extraordinary." You know, and I feel like that sort of seems to be the sort of central thing that I keep seeing in your work. Where I could imagine you guys are just saying, "Like, let's just be great. How about we just be great on this one?"
We quite often. Because we're certainly subject to value management like any other architects out there, but we always just say, like, don't look at the individual number. Like, let us control the total figure, because certainly there are aspects in our projects that cost a lot, but there are also some projects that if you looked at them, you'd be surprised or amazed at how little they cost as well. Some of our earliest projects, you know, Parwana Kuchi Delhi was, I think the budget was $65,000, and all of the materials were either found or traded on Marketplace or Gumtree at the time, or bought from Bunnings.
Yeah, I don't think Marketplace existed.
Yeah. you know, there were even, you know, in the early days, this is before my time with Studio Graham, but Graham was building, you know, some of the festival, you know, sites. So, you know, things don't necessarily need to be expensive or perhaps.
But when they need to be, there's also, I think, a cleverness in making them inherent in the design. So there are certain things you can design into a space that can't be value managed out. You know, materials are easy fruit for builders or quantity surveyors to pick on. Structures not so easy for them to pick on. So there are ways to kind of integrate the things that are important as well. But yeah, it's a, you know, I think it's always a juggle. We certainly we certainly have the same meetings that you're talking about, where we probably do sometimes go, well, why can't, you know, let's just make it better. The answer is not always okay. Sometimes it is. That's a testament to our clients, I guess. Sometimes we push their budgets a little bit further than they want them to be pushed, and we tend to kind of meet in the middle somewhere. But I think, there's a way to, I guess, you know, dance around that sometimes.
Part of that's perhaps the way that we approach the design concept phase. We have these visual briefs, you know, through reference projects and mood imagery, but we have these written narratives that we write as part of our return brief. And if you look at our website, some of the 100 or 200 word descriptions that are on our website describing a project are those, or most of them are those that we presented at the first kind of design concept presentation. And probably getting the client to buy into the design narrative up front allows us to use that as a design tool, you know, in that when there's discussions around value management, we can bring it back to the narrative, which is the backbone of the project, and really define whether or not, you know, stripping out a material or a piece of the design is actually going to compromise the design narrative. So, I think that's perhaps a helpful tool through the design process that's allowed us to sometimes get clients to commit to the things that are expensive.
Yeah, that sounds like a great design anchor for the whole team, so everyone knows, oh, that's the goal we're shooting for. Let's still keep aiming for that. That's why we came here in the first place. And I also loved hearing from you guys about how, as incredible as the learning the design process is in architects, you know, we have a bit of an introduction to things like graphics or production design and various things. You guys also work with incredible, you know, contractors and people who do your logos and graphics, websites and all of these things. And I think that's also a testament to the work that you produced, where you're also great collaborators, not just in architecture, but then also with so many other great creatives as well. So I guess that serves you very well.
Yeah, I think that's the true definition, at least in our minds, of collaboration. It's when you bring people with, you know, individual skill sets, bring them to the table, and then the outcome is the result of, you know, everyone doing their best. And I think we've been, if we go back to some of the earlier conversations around, you know, partnering with bigger practices, you know, that's something that we've learned throughout the journey, I guess, is to just make sure that, yeah, a true collaboration is, yeah, where not everyone's working on the same piece, but people are bringing their own kind of skill sets or resources to the table. I think that's when projects truly benefit from collaboration. And we've been lucky, you know, yeah, to work with some amazing people throughout the past 10 years and continue to do so. And yeah.
Yeah, I don't think any of our projects would be the same without them, that's for sure. And I think for us, it's always been about working with those people. So whether it's bringing them on to projects or conversely engaging them to do things for us, so whether it's photography or graphic design or website design, we're always, I think we're kind of firm believers in using, you know, the people that are the best at what they can do. And that comes from, I think, you know, we talk a lot about, and architects generally talk a lot about how half your job as an architect is convincing someone why they should use an architect. But then I think architects can often sometimes be their own worst enemies, because then they think that they can do graphic design, they can do photography, they can do, you know, they can put on all the other hats. And I think, you know, we do through university get exposed to kind of playing in those spaces. But ultimately, I think, you know, there are certainly graphic designers that can do it a lot better than we can. There are photographers that can do it a lot better than we can. So we, in the same way that we try to sell our services, we're very quick to engage other people for their services.
Yeah, no, it definitely comes through in your work, because it's just, such high quality. So yeah, I think we've covered all the ground that we're hoping to talk about today. So I just wanted to say thank you so much to both of you, Graham and Dave, for giving me so much of your time today and for talking about the genesis of Studio Graham and where the practice is going. I think it's just going to go, things are just going to get better and better. I'm going to see better and better work as we go along. So thank you so much for your time and talking to us about how you can just being awesome, you know, just do great work, just be brilliant. So thank you so much.
Oh, we love the chat. It's, we love, you know, talking about architecture, maybe not so much about ourselves, but it's been great. I love that. So thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
This has been Hearing Architecture, proudly sponsored by Brickworks. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much to our guests, registered architects and directors of Studio Graham, Dave Bickmore and Graham Carbonell. Thank you so much for talking about your inspiring work. We can't wait to see what you do next. Our sponsor Brickworks also produce architecture podcasts hosted by Tim Ross. You can find The Art of Living, Architects Abroad and The Power of Two at brickworks.com.au or your favourite podcast platform. If you'd like to show your support, please rate, review and subscribe to Hearing Architecture in your favourite podcast app. If you want to know more about what the Australian Institute of Architects is doing to support architects and the community, please visit architecture.com.au. This is a production by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. The Institute production team was Madeline Jenkins and Claudia McCarthy, and the Imagine production team was Daniel Moore. This content is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Architects, Emerging Architects and Graduates Network, in collaboration with Open Creative Studio. This content does not take into account specific circumstances and should not be relied on in that way. This content does not constitute legal, financial, insurance, or other types of advice. You should seek independent verification or advice before relying on this content in circumstances where loss or damage may result. The Institute endeavours to publish content that is accurate at the time it is published, but does not accept responsibility for content that may or will become inaccurate over time.